You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. You know, a couple of weeks ago, we brought you the story of a mutual aid group that formed last year during the pandemic. It's called Bicycle Meals. They deliver meals to unhoused people in Koreatown on bicycles. They're still cycling along, but they're not so sure about how much longer they can go until their funds run out. Here's co-founder Mike Pack.
It's a mixture of donations, weekly donations that we'll split, try to split. But for the most part, it's out of pocket. And I think just talking with everyone and long-term wise, I don't think that's feasible and possible for us to do.
Now, during the pandemic, lots of groups like that sprung up and got big spikes in donations and volunteers. But are you still opening your purse or wallet to help out your fellow Angeleno? Or has that urge tapered off now that the city has opened up? You've gotten busier, maybe working or commuting more, and trying to put the pandemic in the rearview mirror. KCRW's Angel Carreras talked to a few pandemic-born mutual aid groups to find out how they're doing right now. Hey, Angel.
Hey, Steve.
So before we jump into this, let's talk about what exactly is a mutual aid group.
Well, think of it as basically a DIY group of locals volunteering to get together and help other locals in need. It's all volunteer-driven, as opposed to a charity or nonprofit that's more of an established institution where people can get paid.
All right. So the obvious question out of the way, how are these groups faring these days?
Well, there's a lot of drop-off with some in terms of money and participation.
Let's talk about one group, Angel, that we highlighted on this show a while back. It was called Water Drop LA. You know, it's hot outside. I think of people needing water these days, especially the unhoused population. So what happened to Water Drop LA?
Yeah, well, as a refresher for those of you that didn't hear that story, Water Drop LA is a mutual aid group started by USC students. They brought and still bring water to unhoused people in Skid Row. They were all over social media last year, especially during those hotter than normal days. Last year, they really raised a lot of money to provide water. Here's co-founder Aria Catano on both those things.
If you were in LA last year, you might remember a couple days in September that were over 110 degrees. And where we were in downtown LA, it was 117. And so those days we raised over $100,000 per day. And it was definitely overwhelming because we hadn't intended on starting a nonprofit. We didn't even have our nonprofit paperwork at the time. We had filed, but we were waiting on it.
So then they became a nonprofit and scaled up a bit with some of those leftover donations. They started working with farm workers up in Coachella Valley and Oxnard, giving them clean water. And then
during the winter, people kind of stopped donating. And I think a large part of that was just because when it's not as hot outside and people, you know, aren't experiencing the heat in the same way, it just kind of, they don't think about how unhoused folks don't have water as much versus when it's really hot.
I mean, you know, the donations follow the need, right? The need at present. And, you know, it's getting really hot again now, isn't it?
True. And though they're not hitting 100K a day anymore, Catano says they still get a steady stream of donations. She would love to see those donations reach those heights again, but she's not exactly holding her breath.
It's possible that we'll see similar levels, but honestly, I'm pessimistic because I think last year, people, because of the Black Lives Matter movement as well, were a lot more inclined to pay attention and to open their pockets and to give back to their communities. A lot of that was out of social pressure. And so as we move into this year and people, you know, can now go buy a cocktail for $15 instead of donating $15, I'm suspecting that we'll see lower rates of fundraising.
Angel, are other mutual aids that you've been in contact with seeing this big rise last year and then a big drop now?
Yeah, one helper I talked to thinks people are exhausted, overwhelmed thinking about all the hardships out there. And that's Zara Bloom. During the pandemic, she started Care Packs LA, which hands out hygiene packs to unhoused and low-income people in and around East Hollywood. She's since started to partner with other mutual aid groups to cast a wider net, make a bigger impact. And Bloom is heavily involved in helping unhoused folks in Echo Park Lake, where she saw a huge spike after getting involved in that whole thing. It's been kind of up and down since then.
I don't know if it's going to be consistent because with mutual aid, you don't know. Like, you're just constantly trying to do this. And I think a lot of people are super burnt out because of the pandemic. itself, period. Burnt out, like, from seeing, like, all these unhoused people. Burnt out from the politicians saying they're going to do stuff. They don't do it. The criminalization of homelessness. People are so tired that they don't want to even deal with it, you know? So I don't think they're paying as much attention as they were before.
It's not just the volunteers who burn out and drift away. It can be hard for the people who started up the groups in the first place. There's all this energy around the needs in the community last year, and Tabisa Leigh Griffin, for instance, co-founded People for People LA during the pandemic. They deliver groceries and prescriptions to people who are especially vulnerable to COVID-19 in communities of color. They started off hot and mainly through word of mouth, built a solid base of 300 interchangeable volunteers and a steady stream of donations.
Mutual aid got more popular as a concept and as a theory and as a material practice as well. So that was kind of on our side, because when we first started, you didn't see like those mutual aid info memes, you know, on social media, or you didn't see like people weren't publishing on it quite yet, or people weren't talking about it or hashtagging or what have you.
Griffin was waking up at 6 a.m., balancing a strict schedule while working towards a PhD. That, topped with the devastation the pandemic wrought close to home, caused her to take a step back.
I was overwhelmed by kind of like the social and emotional and material devastation that was plaguing the city, like January and February. It just felt like a city that had failed so many people, and everybody that was struggling was like right next door, and it could have been us, you know?
She took a break about 2 months ago, and People for People LA took a pause last month. She says when their batteries are fully recharged, People for People LA 2.0 will come back, also helping unhoused and tenants' rights groups. And so it's been a long pandemic, and now while the state opens up and people resume their lives, the mutual aid groups are trying to evolve, still trying to be helpful and go where the needs are.
By the way, there are still plenty of needs. KCRW's Angel Carreras on Mutual Aid Groups. Angel, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving along now with Greater LA on KCRW, Steve Chiotakis here. And now to the Herculean effort to get people vaccinated against COVID-19. All the while, cases are once again on the rise in LA County among the unvaccinated. About 2.5 million people in LA County who are eligible for the shot have not yet gotten it, many choosing not to for a variety of reasons. But for others, it remains a matter of access. The county has transitioned from mass vaccination sites to smaller sites and mobile units in marginalized communities, but homebound residents need even more personal care. That's why, for the past 4 months, nurses with Oxford Healthcare here in LA have been going out to people's homes where they've administered more than 1,000 vaccinations. Joining me now are a couple of those nurses involved in the program, Nicole Landis and Savannah Becker. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Steve. Thanks so much for having us.
Hey, Steve.
Nicole, I want to start with you since you've gone into many of these homes. How many homebound patients do you think you vaccinated?
Oh, wow. To be honest, I actually could not give you an exact number. I vaccinated some of the special needs families that are unable to leave their home, as well as the elderly, that it takes so much work to load their family members in and out of their car.
I mean, what neighborhoods do you typically go to? I mean, who are these patients? I assume mostly you mentioned elderly people, people with certain health and mobility issues. Do you find also that there's maybe some reluctance or they don't know enough about the vaccine?
Absolutely. I would say that one of the biggest opportunities that I'm given as an in-home bound nurse doing these homebound vaccines is education. I know our goal here is to get as many numbers as possible, as many people vaccinated. However, the biggest thing that I run into is resistance with family members or just uneducated about the whole vaccine and about COVID itself. So I would say my biggest honor is being able to teach about COVID and be able to reach more people in the home.
What neighborhoods are you usually in?
We actually service all of LA County. I'm typically assigned to one specific area. On some days, I start my days in Santa Monica, go all the way to Culver City. Sometimes I end up in Hollywood, Compton. We hit all of LA County.
And if you had to count, you know, like in a day, how many vaccinations do you usually give out?
We try to stay anywhere between 6 and 8 home visits a day. We typically spend about 30 minutes or more, depending on the number of people we vaccinate. We have to stay about 30 minutes with each person for an observation period.
Savannah, I want to talk to you about, you know, you sort of act as the hub for the program, right? You're the one who's you know, the liaison who's trying to get people involved. How do you find the folks who need your help? Are people reaching out to you, or do you cold call people? How does that work?
We're in constant communication with our office, and we have an outreach team who works with the LA County Department of Public Health. So we're constantly trying to market and advertise these vaccines so that people know that we're able to come to their home. That's because what we found is that for a lot of people, they simply didn't know that we offered this service. So between our amazing team, you know, Max Health, Oxford Health, and the LA County Department of Public Health, we really are trying to market and advertise, and then have that office staff available to kind of help field the phone calls, get them scheduled, and then get a nurse out to the home in a timely manner.
As I said at the outset, there are about 2.5 million people here in LA County not vaccinated. Again, some choosing not to, a lot of folks choosing not to. Do you think there are still a lot of people out there who need special help, though? Like, I mean, just from your perspective, seeing how many people are reaching out to you, or are you trying to advertise to people to make sure that they know that you're there? I mean, are a lot of people in need of special help?
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. So as you know, the pandemic has created a lot of really unique problems for people. And a lot of people have been in their homes for the last year or more. So using our resources, you know, again, marketing, trying to reach these people through TV, radio interviews like this, or online advertising, you know, letting people know that, one, we can come to you, and then also we can educate and provide that support and demystify any, you know, misinformation that they may have heard about the vaccine. But just from our outreach and our on the ground, you know, grassroots effort, educating them on the importance of this vaccine mission. Yeah, I absolutely think that there are still people that need our help.
What's some of the misinformation that you're hearing?
So people are mostly just scared. You know, there's, you know, a few voices that are very loud about terrible side effects, et cetera. So just being able to kind of sit down individually one-on-one with those patients, caregivers, or family members, and ask them specifically what their questions or fears are. The CDC, and they have a lot of great resources on their website. So something that I like to do is just present objective facts. You know, from studies conducted by the CDC. So when you give people that objective information, you're saying, hey, this is not an opinion. This is cold, hard facts. So it's really just a lot of fear surrounding it. Some people are honestly just terrified of being poked. You know, they're scared of the injection itself. So,
Yeah. You
know, we have a really amazing, competent, experienced, professional team that we can send out into these homes. So, you know, providing these people with not only that kind of cerebral support of like, hey, this is the facts, but then also, you know, sending someone who's extremely experienced, like Nicole, into these homes, that kind of gives us the perfect approach to those who might be hesitant.
Nicole, what's the experience like going into someone's home, you know, who's probably been pretty isolated during the pandemic? I imagine it can be quite personal, right? And maybe even emotional.
Oh, yes, Steve. I definitely get mixed feelings. Just as Savannah had stated, you know, when we get into the homes of patients that have been at home for literally 1 year, they're so paranoid about even myself coming into their home. And now I am in full PPE gear. However, they still are so scared and so nervous of any human contact. Once I do break that shield and I let them know I am there to protect them, I am there to make sure that they're getting the healthcare that they need and that they've been missing out on for this whole time, it kind of breaks them down a little bit. And then they open up and they talk talk about how lonely they've been for the last year and how thankful they are that we're finally giving this opportunity to come into their home so they don't have to leave. Because that is honestly the number one thing that I hear in the homes is these patients are so terrified to leave their house. And they're so thankful that this opportunity is welcome to them and that we are able to come to their home and provide this.
Is there one patient, somebody who you have in mind, stands out in your mind?
For me personally, I have a pediatric background. So honestly, when I get into my special needs kids that don't have that opportunity to go stand in a CVS line, and the family is so thankful, these kids just truly don't understand what's going on in the world right now and that I'm there to protect them. And keeping them at home in their home where they're most safe and where they feel most comfortable, and me being able to provide that in their house, the family is so thankful. They're still getting the protection they need without having to go stand in a CVS line. And I've heard families tell me how intimidating it could be because people are constantly staring. So for me personally, it's any of my pediatric patients that I've truly felt that connection with.
Savannah, number one, how many nurses like Nicole do you have in the field on any given day?
Yeah, so the really unique thing about our operation is the scalability. So on any given day, it's really about the needs of our community. So if we have a lot of appointments, you know, we send out more nurses. But if we have a slower day where there's not necessarily as many appointments, you know, we can scale back a bit. But that's my favorite thing about it is just the instant ability to react and scale as necessary so we can meet the needs of the community.
Can you meet the needs, though? Are there days where it's like, oh, we don't have enough?
You know, of course, in healthcare, as we've seen over the last year, COVID has put a unique kind of stress on the healthcare industry. In my experience, however, you know, with the professionalism of Max Health, Oxford Health, and the LA County Department of Public Health, I personally have never felt that we're not able to meet the needs of the community. We're all working as a team. So by using that team approach with these different organizations, we're really able to, again, scale as necessary because everyone understands how important this is.
If someone is listening, Savannah, who wants to take advantage of this program for themselves, or maybe there's a family member or somebody whom they know, what should they do?
Yeah, it's 818-431-5466. And just communicate to that person, whoever picks up the phone, that you'd like to receive an in-home COVID vaccination, and they'll go through the process with you.
Well, thank you to you both for coming on and talking to us about it. Nicole Landis and Savannah Becker, both nurses at Oxford Healthcare. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much for your time.
Let's go!
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. And finally today, a couple of new art exhibits to check out all summer long that both reflect different aspects of Americana. One from the late, great John Baldessari, and the other a solo show from Jamaican-born and New York-based artist Neri Ward. Our art insider Lindsay Preston-Zapp has checked them out. She's here to tell us about them. She's editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, or Carla. Hey, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
Let's start with this new show at Jeffrey Deitch. It's called Say Can You See? This is from the artist Neri Ward. What struck you most about this exhibit? Obviously, Oh Say Can You See, right? We know what that's about.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's already getting you on this kind of conceptual level. You're thinking of America. You're thinking of the national anthem. But the work all has such this, like, a rich material history. He's working a lot with found objects, shoes, clothing, used clothing, bottles. Some work has oven pans, fire hoses, church pews. So all of this work is being built with these objects, which have a really dense past history and life, and kind of building a context from there. There are also these pieces where he embeds shoelaces directly into the wall to spell out different words. And the shoelaces kind of hang down and kind of have this evocative feeling to them. And these objects really become symbolic in the stories that he's telling. In the center of the show, there's this piece called Still Lifes with Stepladders. And the artist was really thinking about memorials that have popped up in his Harlem neighborhood in the last year. And, you know, people set up little bottles and flowers and how these kind of look like still life. So it's sort of a play on memorials and still lives. But the work is really thinking about memory and loss and all the loss that we've experienced in the last year. But also connecting that to the Black American experience and addressing issues of race and class and even consumer culture.
The name of the show, Lindsay, is from one specific piece. It's a giant American flag that's covered in plastic security tags.
Yeah.
What is Neri Ward saying with this piece?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge. I don't know the exact scale, but it goes up the wall, huge flag, and it almost looks beaded or bedazzled at first, but then you get up close and you realize it's security tags, like would be on, you know, an expensive garment at a store, and they take off for you before you leave the store. You know, using two symbols that have a lot of kind of conceptual tension and placing them together and building off of that. And I think this idea of America as this consumer nation, we're always purchasing newer and better things. And this really contrasts some of the found materiality and the objects in the rest of the show. And again, brings up this issue of class and the disparity of economic experiences that people have in our country.
As I mentioned, the other exhibit is from John Baldessari. It is the final show from him before he died last year. Who was John Baldessari, for the folks who don't know, and what's in this exhibit?
So John Baldessari is such a key figure in art, and specifically in the conceptual art movement. He's often called the father of postmodernism. No pressure, you know. But he really helped to define this kind of West Coast style of conceptual art making. John really worked with humor, and he loved, you know, making jokes and having kind of punchlines. He often worked with images that are sourced from film stills and would manipulate them and cover people's faces or body parts, and really working with this method of eliminating information. And another kind of key facet of his work is text. So he really thought that images and text were almost interchangeable and often uses the two to create meaning. So for this show, he started with black and white photographs that are found film stills and different kind of archival images that he has just massive stores of. And he printed those on canvas and then painted over sections of the painting with either white or black paint. So there are really specific parts of each photo that he leaves revealed and other parts that are concealed. And then below that, there's this text that kind of points you to what you're looking at. So, you know, his work is really all about looking and perception and sort of making the viewer think about how we construct meaning on a daily basis.
The show is called The Space Between. The title, I guess, lends itself to the beginning of all the pieces in the show, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the text at the bottom underneath each of these photographs says the space between, and then it'll be the space between two cowboys or the space between two legs. And what's so fascinating about the work is that the areas that are redacted and painted over with the paint kind of flip back and forth. So sometimes they don't quite match what is left visible in the photograph. So for instance, the space between two cowboys shows two cowboys standing next to wagon wheels, but the background has been erased. So you don't really know where they are. Are they actual cowboys? Are they actors? Are they, you know, in a Western film? And then in others, the text doesn't even match really what's happening. So there's one called The Space Between Two Legs, which pictures a man whose head has also been erased, and he's holding a gun. And the text doesn't, you know, even address the obvious fact that he's pointing a gun. So it kind of, again, creates this tension and really building meaning through that and kind of directing our looking.
Do you have a favorite piece in this show of the things that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, I really gravitated to the more esoteric compositions. There's one that was called The Space Between Pocket and Ear. So these two things, it was kind of a pocket in a shirt and then an ear. And that's the only two things you can see in this film still. And everything else has been kind of whited out. But the ear is really down low and the pocket's up top in the composition. So it really sets up, again, a tension. And you're not really sure how these two things are sharing space. And then there's several that really highlighted negative space. So it was like this actual space between things, where everything else has been erased. So there's one called the space between roof, sand, hat, neck, and arm. But the only thing you see is this kind of abstract, weird shape that sort of looks like it's dirt or rock. So it really leaves you as a viewer to kind of connect the language with what you're looking at. Both of these shows are up through the summer, so there's plenty of time to go see them. Neri Ward is up at Jeffrey Deitch through August, and John Baldessari is at Spruithmagers right across the street from LACMA through September.
Lindsay Preston Zappas, our art insider, editor-in-chief at Carla. Lindsay, as always, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, another heartbreaking tale of a foster child who'd fallen through the cracks, who ends up in the child welfare system in the first place, and the concerns about racial bias and what happens when social workers make the wrong decision about keeping kids safe. That's tomorrow on this program. Subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Also, here's a chance to win tickets to more than 70 live shows spanning musical styles, genres, venues, including Chicano Batman, Jungle, Caribou, and much more by entering KCRW's Golden Ticket Sweepstakes. We're celebrating the return of in-person concerts. A truly massive prize, and all the while you're supporting the station that supports you back. KCRW.com/give for more information. The sweepstakes, by the way, ends tonight. Good luck. So nice to get back out there. You guys, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on this evening's show. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your ears and time tonight. Have a great night.